for this April the 29th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. And here are some of your Thursday headlines. It is day 100 for the Biden administration as the president sells his message to voters in Georgia and across the country. He spent part of the afternoon in Plains, Georgia, with the 39th president, Jimmy Carter. In his speech last night, President Biden formally announcing his $1.8 trillion American Families Plan that includes universal preschool, free community college, and expanded access to child care. It also comes a month after the Biden White House introducing a $2 trillion infrastructure plan. The administration says it would modernize 20,000 miles of roads and 10,000 bridges, as well expand access to broadband services, but Republicans are balking at the price tag and the proposed new tax hikes. In the coronavirus headlines, New York City, the one-time epicenter of COVID-19, aiming for a full reopening by July 1st, that according to Mayor Bill de Blasio. Moderna plans to manufacture up to 3 billion doses of its vaccine next year. The company says it believes there still will be a significant need for shots and for boosters. The CDC is reaffirming it is, quote, committed to resuming cruises into the U.S. by midsummer. Cruise operations have been halted for more than a year because of the pandemic. And the State Department issuing a level 4 travel advisory, urging Americans to leave India as soon as possible amid a record COVID surge in that country. Just some of the stories shaping Washington Today, ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. We begin in Baltimore, where Vice President Kamala Harris spending part of the day marking the 100th day of the Biden-Harris administration. She was there to talk about COVID-19, the vaccination program, and also pitching the White House's massive jobs and family aid packages, issues that will be considered in what is a sharply divided Congress. More with the Vice President.
President, in his speech last night, he talked about this plan that will establish universal pre-K and lower the cost of childcare, making childcare affordable and accessible, which has been a priority for so many of us. Just think, nearly 2 million women have been forced out of the workforce in just the last year. And a lack of childcare is often the reason why. You know, I'll tell you my personal story on this. You know, when my mother, who raised my sister and me, Dr. Fauci knows this. I'm very proud to say that my mother used to go to this place, Governor, when we were young. Mommy was going always to this place called Bethesda. She was going to Bethesda, I learned later, because a place called NIH is in Bethesda. Because, you see, my mother was a breast cancer researcher. And she had two goals in her life, to raise her two daughters and breast cancer. And so she used to go out to NIH to help do some of the work that happens there. And so when my mother, though, on a daily basis was at work every day, long hours, she worked on weekends. And when she was at work, and it was after school, often my sister and I, we would walk two houses down to the home of Mrs. Regina Shelton, who was a second mother to us. And she was a lifeline for our mother. And here's the thing I know. She would talk on a daily basis about how, but for Miss Shelton, she could not have done the work that she did. Every working mother needs that support. Every working parent needs that support.
Those remarks by Vice President Kamala Harris. She was in Baltimore. And this side note, she actually based her presidential campaign in Baltimore before dropping out of the race back in 2019. The president in Georgia this evening, first with a meeting with former President Jimmy Carter in Plains, and tonight a campaign rally just outside of Atlanta. CBS News White House correspondent Ed O'Keefe is in Georgia. We'll check in with him in just a moment. But first, from last night's speech before a joint session of Congress, a speech we carried live here on C-SPAN Radio, President Biden outlining his goals and his vision, the role of the federal government.
In our first 100 days together, we've acted to restore people's faith in democracy to deliver. We're vaccinating the nation. We're creating hundreds of thousands of new jobs. We're delivering real results to people. They can see it, feel it in their own lives. Opening doors of opportunity, guaranteeing some more fairness and justice. That's the essence of America. That's democracy in action. Our Constitution opens with the words, as trite as it sounds, we the people. Well, it's time to remember that we the people are the government. You and I. not some force in a distant capital, not some powerful force that we have no control over. It's us. It's we, the people. In another era, when our democracy was tested, Franklin Roosevelt reminded us, in America, we do our part. We all do our part. That's all I'm asking, that we do our part, all of us. And if we do that, we will meet the center challenge of the age by proving that democracy is durable and strong.
The president last night, before a joint session of Congress, Ed O'Keefe, senior White House and political correspondent for CBS News, is traveling with the president. He is in Duluth, Georgia tonight. Give us a sense of how the administration today and moving forward is trying to sell the message.
Well, Steve, they're doing what presidents often do after their first big address to Congress or their annual address to Congress. They're hitting the road and selling the plan now to regular everyday Americans. He's starting the sales pitch here in Georgia, a state, of course, that was critical to his win last year and also to Democrats winning total control of Congress. This is the state that this president is likely to return to early and often to shore up support here ahead of next year's critical midterms, where you've got a handful of House and Senate races in play here in the Peach State, and then, of course, his own reelection in 2024. He will talk, we're told, about the two big infrastructure bills that have yet to be fully considered or voted on in Congress, the American Jobs Plan and the American Families Plan. Add them up, they equal about $4 trillion. And, you know, they're facing unified Republican opposition. So he's got to find a way to convince the American public to get on the phone or get on the Twitter and convince Congress they've got to act. And even if Republicans refuse to at least build enough support to allow Democrats to do so on their own, as they did earlier this year with the American Rescue Plan. So he'll go from here in Georgia and then to Pennsylvania. He was on the road today. So was the vice president. She made a stop at Baltimore.
You know Capitol Hill very well, and not only Republicans unified against any tax increase, but some key senators. Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, Joe Manchin of West Virginia. How does he bring those people along?
It's a good question, and that's part of what is going to prolong this for probably the next 2 or 3 months, really, before Congress can settle this issue. And it's not just Manchin and Sinema in the Senate. You've got a handful of members of the House who may get squeezed by Republicans for supporting this, or who come from those higher tax states like California, New York, and New Jersey, and want to see some other things done to the state and local tax exemptions that were stripped away by the Trump administration. So, Republicans are going to continue to point out to this White House, you think you got an issue with us, go look at your own party. And perhaps the best example they saw last night came out of not out of nowhere, but was notable, and that was the other Arizona Democratic Senator, Mark Kelly, who issued a statement out of concern that the president didn't talk much about border security in his presidential address, a sign that not only on this issue, but on other ones, he's going to have some issues with members of his own party. And part of the reason it's notable that Kelly did that is because if you look at all those 100 days polls that were released this week, consistently they showed the one issue that the American public is not happy with the president about is his handling of the immigration crisis.
Let me turn from policy to the optics last night. Only about 200 members of the House and Senate, really about an eighth of what normally would be in the chamber for a speech like that. As you watched the speech overall, Ed O'Keefe, what was your assessment?
My assessment, Steve, is the first maybe third of that speech was designed to be a national television address, a president talking to the country, to individual voters, trying to explain what he's trying to do. But I got a sense later on that it was becoming less of a presidential address to the nation in front of Congress and more of a presidential address to Congress with the country watching. In essence, a former lawmaker talking to his former colleagues about what they need to get done and how he thinks they can do it. And you saw him sort of, you know, blunt his attacks or his criticisms of Republicans or of Congress generally, soften the edges a little bit by ad-libbing off of the prepared marks the White House had sent us, and the way he referenced people like Peter McConnell or others who have worked with him on issues in the past. Even at the end, when he said, thank you for your patience, sort of a wink and a nod to lawmakers who know that these addresses can be a bit exhaustive to sit through, having sat through more than 30 of them himself as a senator before sitting through 8 of them as vice president. The other thing I thought was interesting and I made a point of this last night on our coverage, was I cannot recall an American president in a formal address setting like this ever speaking so frankly to fellow Americans about the rising tides of China and how bound and determined the Chinese government is to ensure that their country becomes the dominant one in this world. And it's part of his nagging, gnawing concern about the fate of democracies versus autocracies in the world, but also a signal that he thinks about China constantly. I mean, we've heard him talk about it in his first press conference. We've heard him talk about it a lot on the campaign trail. But to devote as much time as he did there to speak pretty plainly to Americans about what he knows about President Xi and what he knows the Chinese are up to and how it could affect our economy and how our own political problems could allow autocratic countries like China to get ahead and how that concerns him, I thought was a really interesting new way to talk about that and to compel his former colleagues to act. But also one of those moments that I think could rank as a really notable one in presidential speeches when it comes to the foreign policy references, because in many ways he may have been foreshadowing what he hopes does not happen, but what could potentially happen over the next few years or decades. And that is the real rise of China and deeper conflict between the United States and that country.
Let me conclude on this note. Remind our listeners, we're talking with Ed O'Keefe. He is traveling with the president in Georgia. Senator Joe Biden was elected in 1972. He was a freshman senator when Jimmy Carter was elected in 1976. And the two together in Plains, Georgia today. What was that moment like? What are the images coming out of Plains?
We actually didn't get many images, Steve, according to the pool reports, because we're not with them in Plains. We're here in Metro Atlanta. But according to the pool reports, he went into the Carter home with First Lady Jill Biden. They went to see the Carters, and when they emerged, the only Carter we saw was the former First Lady Rosalynn Carter. Both of them, the Carters, are in their 90s, have not been seen much in public over the course of the pandemic. Mr. Carter did not attend the Biden inauguration. We know they spoke the night before. There's a documentary about the former president coming out this weekend, and there's going to be a bit of an event around it here in Georgia. And the president appears in a video tribute that is set to air as part of this event and recalls what you just mentioned, that as a young senator, he was the first to endorse Carter's 76 campaign. And he said he had colleagues who thought it was a bit of youthful exuberance. And he acknowledged that perhaps it was, but that ultimately Carter won and impressed him and proved his point that he could be a good and faithful Democratic president. And also pays tribute to his post-presidency, saying that he has really been the model of a public servant with an emphasis on the servant. So we'll see if he has more to say about that visit in the hours and days to come, but it appears to have been a pretty quick and private meeting between the two presidents. This is a current president who has been far more willing and eager to speak with his predecessors, with the exception of one, of course, former President Trump. But we know that he's been in frequent touch with President Obama. He spoke with President Bush about the decision to withdraw from Afghanistan. He now has seen President Carter, and of course he saw President Clinton at his inauguration. So I think over the course of the Biden presidency, we're going to hear a lot more about how often he reached out to his predecessors to discuss things, knowing now that he's a member of one of the most exclusive clubs in the world.
Ed O'Keefe, we will look for your reporting tonight on the CBS Evening News and the digital network CBSN, joining us from Atlanta. Thank you for being with us.
As always, Steve, great to be with you.
And now more on the politics and the spending. Republicans very critical of the massive scope of federal spending so far in the Biden administration. With more on that, here is Louisiana Senator John Kennedy earlier today.
If you juxtapose President Biden's speech with Senator Scott's speech, it's a very different philosophy of government. President Biden clearly believes that that government made America great, and only government can keep us great. And Senator Scott, with whom I agree, believes that the president could not be more wrong. What made America great and what will ensure our future, ordinary people doing extraordinary things. And that's really the difference today between Democrats and Republicans. Democrats believe they put all their faith in government. Republicans put their faith in people. I was disappointed in President Biden's speech. It's clear to me that he could have done his speech in about 30 seconds. He could have walked up and said, I'm President Biden. Thank you for watching. Here's my message. I want all of you to send every bit of your money and freedom to Washington. Thank you for watching. I mean, that's his philosophy, and I don't agree with it. And I've been very disappointed in his first 100 days. He's a modest man, but based on his record, he has much to be modest about. It's been a very radical agenda. And I don't think it's supported by the American people.
That assessment from Republican Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana on Capitol Hill. At the start of last night's speech, President Biden opened his remarks with a historic moment.
Thank you all, Madam Speaker, Madam Vice President. No president has ever said those words from this podium. No president has ever said those words, and it's about time.
Well, today, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, was asked about what that meant for her.
Last night was historic. It was the first time two women, the Vice President of the United States and the Speaker of the House, sat behind the President as he delivered his address to the nation. It sent the message to girls and women that beyond the sky is the limit. We would say the sky is the limit years ago, but now with the technology that we see, there is no limit. The president's speech reflected that message. It's one thing to have two women there. It's remarkable, actually, I say immodestly. But what's really important about the night was what the president said in his speech. It was a triumph for women. Women at home, women in the workplace. Equal pay for equal work. Paid family and medical leave. Affordable child care. Universal pre-K. I love that because it's children learning, parents earning. Men and women, but largely women as caregivers. The Violence Against Women Act that he urged the passage of in the Senate. And many other initiatives for women. The list goes on. This address was a recognition that we can only build back better with the fuller participation of women in our economy.
If it's Thursday, a weekly news conference by the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and those comments, her reaction to the speech last night by President Biden, which, by the way, is available on our website at cspan.org. And Republican Senator Tim Scott delivering the GOP response last evening in which he signaled a bitter fight to come over President Biden's efforts to increase government assistance to workers, students, and families. He called the $1.8 trillion American Families Plan big government waste. And today, Senator Scott, on a different issue, joining lawmakers from both parties to discuss the reform of police as Congress tries to craft a bill that can get through a narrowly divided U.S. Capitol. Eight senators and House members part of those talks here in Washington. And after the meeting, Senator Scott with these remarks.
That meeting with a sense that you can find a compromise?
I'm always optimistic that we can, and nothing happened in the meeting that deterred me from being optimistic that we can get there.
Okay. So can you meet the May 25th deadline, do you think?
I didn't see the May 25th deadline. I think the best thing we can do is keep in mind why we're doing what we're doing, and what we're doing is trying to make our communities and our law enforcement community easier to work together. And I think as long as we keep that as our focus, we will work expeditiously to get to a solution.
How do you answer the families who want to hold individual police officers accountable? What do you say?
Well, first, I just met with them, so what I said to them, I've already said to them, and I'm happy to talk to more family members. I think that's always constructive. Second, I'm not going to negotiate the bill with the press. That's never helpful for actually getting a conclusion. So outside of that, I say nothing to the press, but I have been and will continue to speak to family members who have lost a loved one.
Will you negotiators continue over the recess? Will you continue having your conversations among the lawmakers? Is there any chance of a deal before you come back?
They're still here, so I assume that we'll continue to talk.
You still continue to hold it's a red line for you, Section 242, the issue of intent.
Absolutely.
You're not going to lower that threshold. Is that
that's my position.
and the family members feeling like that's something they want you to give?
Well, what we spent a lot of time on, well, certainly everybody wants you to give on many things. What the family members who spoke to me want is progress that they can measure in a meaningful way. We are going to continue to work on what that looks like, and I'm glad that they are willing to stay engaged. It is informative and educational, and that's good news. That's it for me.
Questions to Senator Tim Scott. He delivered the response last night for the Republicans and today leading the effort in the Senate among Republicans on police reform. Those negotiations between the Democrats and Republicans, as you heard just a moment ago, they will continue. And a bipartisan bill that would boost funding for states' water infrastructure passing the Senate easily, the final vote 89-2, now sending it to the House of Representatives. The measure is called the Drinking Water and Wastewater Infrastructure Act of 2021. It would put $35 billion towards state water programs. In one of the amendments from Senator Marco Rubio, he called the current formula outdated. You'll also hear from Delaware Senator Tom Carper.
This formula is 34 years old. It privileges a handful of states over the vast majority. I think the number is 15 over the other 35. And it's not just me saying it. The EPA issued a report that stated that the current formula does not meet the wastewater needs of most of the states, and it recommended that this be updated regularly. Notably, from the EPA's report, it says the EPA does not know how the current allotment formula was developed. It says, quote, the weighing and factors that were used to establish the formula for the original allotment are not known. My home state of Florida is one of many that are disadvantaged under the current formula. And the result has been obvious over the years. I think most of my colleagues would agree that distributing funds, let alone $14.4 billion, to states without rhyme or reason is not beneficial and it isn't fair. And it's not just states, by the way. This amendment, if passed, would secure more equitable allotments to Native American tribes and territories. Now, Mr. President, unfortunately, and I made it in our drafting of this amendment, there was a small technical error in which instead of stating that it should be 0.025 in the distribution for Native American tribes, it says 0.0025. So I would like to ask unanimous consent to further modify Amendment 1471 with the changes that are at the desk so that the right number is on there.
Is there an objection?
Reserving the right to object. I cannot agree to this unanimous consent request because this is the exact reason why we don't amend complicated formulas on the floor with limited oversight. This bill was hotlined last night, I think, with the current language from Senator Rubio. Now he would like to change it here literally at the last moment. And with all due respect, I just cannot agree to that. I said to him in a conversation off the floor, I think he knows me well enough that I'm willing to work with him and others who would like to see some modifications in this formula going forward. This is not the end of the trail. I mean, we'll have conference with the House, we'll have negotiations with the White House. And I just want to say to him, I look forward to working with him as Senator Capito to consider the changes that he's proposing, but not to do it at the last minute here on the floor. I'm unable to do that, and I reluctantly object, but I'm going to have to do that.
From the Senate floor earlier today with Senator Marco Rubio, Republican of Florida, and Democratic Senator Tom Carper of Delaware. Now to the U.S. economy and this headline from the Wall Street Journal. The economy grew robustly in the first quarter. With more on that story, reporter Josh Mitchell. What did the numbers tell you?
So in the first quarter, the economy grew at an annual rate of 6.4%. That's very good. The question is, how long is that going to last? There is a big expectation that we are at the start of what's going to be a strong year of economic growth. So what it tells us is that the economic recovery is going very well as of now.
6.4%. Can you put that in perspective? How significant is that?
Well, so keep in mind, we are still rebounding from this very, very severe contraction last spring. So, you know, if the economy is expected to grow between 2 to 3% per year on average, that's pretty good. So this is, you know, just this little snapshot in time is very strong growth if you compare it to average growth. But you have to keep in mind, we're still recovering from this severe contraction last year. So, you know, we're still a little bit behind where we were before the pandemic. The size of the economy, even with this big spurt in growth, is about 1% smaller than it was in December 2019 before the pandemic reached the U.S. So yes, growth was very strong, but it's because we have a lot of catching up that we have to do after last year.
What are Americans buying? And I guess more importantly, what does that mean for the supply chain? Because I think we've all seen some huge delays in getting the products that we're trying to order.
Right. So last quarter, you know, the reason why the economy grew so fast is really because consumers bought a lot of what's called durable goods, these long-lasting items. Think about cars, think about bikes, think about, you know, a couch. You know, that's what consumers really shelled out a lot for those things in the first quarter, and that really drove this burst in growth. There are certain things that consumers aren't really spending as heavily on, and that includes going out to restaurants, that includes going out to, you know, the spa, you know, what have you. And that's because a lot of those businesses are still facing capacity restrictions. A lot of states are still saying, for example, if you're a restaurant, you know, you can only, you know, see the number, certain number of people indoors. And so that part of the economy is still lags, but it is starting to pick up. And yes, you know, right now, one of the things that's going out is that the demand is outstripping supply in a lot of areas. For example, I myself went to my local bike shop. I had to replace the chain on my bike. They said it's going to take at least 2.5 weeks to get this part. That usually takes a day or two. And so what's happening right now is a lot of businesses are really having to wait a long time to, you know, get things shipped to them. And, you know, in some ways, in some cases, they're having to actually raise prices to respond to this spike in sales.
And what about that $1,400 stimulus payment that so many Americans received? That will not continue moving ahead. How did that impact spending?
So it certainly helped boost consumer spending. There's no doubt about that. But there is still a big amount of savings overall that households have. So it definitely gave the economy a lift, but there's this expectation that that stimulus is still going to filter out to the economy for the rest of this year. Now, the hope is that, yes, consumers are going to continue to spend that money. Businesses are going to continue to reopen. All that spending is going to kickstart growth. Businesses will have to hire in response. And what the hope is that, you know, the stimulus does filter out, but by that point we'll be in what's called, you know, the cycle of growth, where more hiring means more people have more money, and then they go spend, and then, you know, businesses hire. So hopefully we will achieve that cycle. But that is one of the question marks right now. And you know, it does look like things, most economists are optimistic, but there are always risks to the outlook.
A story we'll follow at WSJ.com. Josh Mitchell here in the Washington Bureau for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you for being with us.
Sure, thanks.
The arrows pointed up at the closing bell, the Dow gaining nearly 240 points. The NASDAQ rose 31.5, the S&P up 28. One big reason for the uptick, Amazon shares beating earnings. That stock alone up 44%. You're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back. This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday. The program also available as a podcast. Some of your other headlines in New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo saying he has not been interviewed as part of the state attorney general's investigation into allegations that he sexually harassed a number of women, though Political.com saying he is, quote, eager to tell his side of the story. And in politics, former Interior Secretary in the Trump administration, Ryan Zinke, saying he is running for Congress again, seeking the House seat in his home state of Montana, which, by the way, is gaining a seat following the 2020 census. As we first reported yesterday, federal agents raiding Rudy Giuliani's New York City home and office, seizing computers and cell phones in what is a major escalation of the Justice Department's investigation into his business dealings of former President Trump's personal lawyer. The 76-year-old former New York City mayor, once celebrated for his leadership after 9/11, has been under federal scrutiny for several years over his ties to Ukraine. Now, the search is sending the strongest signal yet that he could eventually face federal charges. He denies any allegations. Agents searching his home on Madison Avenue and his apartment, as well as his Park Avenue office. And during an interview with NBC News, Craig Melvin asking President Biden what he knew about the raid.
Federal investigators searched the home and the office of Rudy Giuliani as part of an investigation into his time as President Trump's attorney, his dealings with Ukraine. Were you aware of that raid before it happened?
I give him my word I was not. I made a pledge. I would not interfere in any way, order, or try to stop any investigation the Justice Department had underway. I learned about that last night when the rest of the world learned about it. My word, I had no idea this was underway.
Have you been briefed on any other investigations involving?
And I'm not asking to be briefed. I'm not asking to be briefed. That's the Justice Department's independent judgment. This last administration politicized the Justice Department so badly, so many of them quit, so many left, because that's not the role. It's not the role of a president to say who should be prosecuted, when they should be prosecuted, who should be not prosecuted. That's not the role of the president. The Justice Department is the people's lawyer, not the president's lawyer.
That from an NBC News interview, but of course, Rudy Giuliani disagreeing with that through his lawyer issuing a statement accusing federal authorities of, quote, a corrupt double standard, invoking allegations that he's pushed against prominent Democrats, and said that the Justice Department was, quote, running roughshod over the constitutional rights of anyone involved in or legally defending former President Donald Trump. Well, on Fox Business this morning, the former president had this reaction.
The greatest mayor in the history of New York, you take a great patriot. You know, Rudy Giuliani is a great patriot. He does these things. He just loves this country. And they raid his apartment. It's like so unfair and such a double. It's like a double standard like I don't think anybody's ever seen before. It's very, very unfair. Rudy is a patriot who loves this country. And I don't know what they're looking for, what they're doing. Very, very unfair situation. You know, you have to understand Rudy. Rudy loves this country so much. It is so terrible when you see things that are going on in our country with the corruption and the problems, and then they go after Rudy Giuliani. It's very sad, actually.
That's from former President Trump. He was on Fox Business earlier today. President Biden's pick to lead the White House's top technology office, pledging to advance equity and diversity in science. Eric Lander's confirmation taking place earlier today, his statement following some concerns from lawmakers, both Democrats and Republicans, over his past record and remarks, as well as his association with the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, who committed suicide. And with questioning from Senator Roger Wicker, Eric Lander trying to ease concerns about gatherings that he and other scientists attended back in 2012 with Epstein.
Senator Duckworth mentioned Jeffrey Epstein. We asked for information regarding the second time you met with him in 2012. Can you commit to fulfilling this outstanding request for information?
Yes, sir, I can. May I say something about Epstein?
Certainly.
Jeffrey Epstein was an abhorrent individual, and my heart goes out to his victims. I chose to have no association whatsoever with him. We never requested funds. We never received funds from him, from his foundation. The sum total of my interactions was that I met him briefly at two events within the span of 3 weeks in the spring of 2012.
Okay, well, I think it's important that you be given a
will.
Chance.
I will, and I did not know about his sordid history before that point. Right. As soon as I learned about it, I had nothing to do with him thereafter.
If you could simply answer our specific question, I think it would help
absolutely.
Your case. And I think people on both sides of the dais would be well
absolutely.
Served.
That from Senator Wicker and Eric Lander during his confirmation hearing to head up the White House Office of Science and Technology. Also on Capitol Hill, New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand continuing to sponsor legislation as she has over the last decade that would remove military commanders from their role in prosecuting service members for issues of sexual assault. Today, she was flanked by a number of lawmakers from both parties announcing her latest effort.
Our bill will require the military to take steps to help prevent the occurrences of serious crimes like sexual assault by improving things like the physical security of our military installations, increasing the training and education on military sexual assault, not just for the service members, but also for the commanders. This bill will also ensure that when these crimes are committed, justice is delivered. It does so by taking the same approach to these cases that the military takes in most every other area of operation. It puts highly technical difficult work in the hands of those who have the most expertise to know how to complete that mission. We need trained specialists. This is a bipartisan and common sense reform that removes the decision of whether to prosecute serious crimes to trained, independent military prosecutors, while misdemeanors and uniquely military crimes stay exactly where they are within the chain of command. By moving this work off the commander's plate, it will empower the command to focus on mission critical issues, rebuilding the trust among their ranks, and building the military readiness that is required.
That assessment from Senator Gillibrand of New York, and joining her, Iowa Republican Senator Joni Ernst.
I spent my first term in the Senate working to get laws in place. Kirsten was a partner on many of those to help improve how we prosecute sexual crimes in the military, bolstering our prevention programs and equipping our future leaders at military academies. When Senator Gillibrand approached me about working with her again this year, as she does every single year, believe me. She keeps a whiteboard, right?
Yes, I have it.
Okay. We decided to take a fresh look at her original bill and how we might tighten the language and improve it. And that's how we reached the Military Justice Improvement and Increasing Prevention Act. Our bipartisan bill still makes modifications to the way that officers handle sexual assault cases by having a military prosecutor decide whether a case should be prosecuted, but we work together to tighten the language to ensure that commanders still know what's going on in their units and are able to keep good order and discipline. One key component that we've focused a lot on, and I've paid particular attention to this in the past, is prevention. And we've added a lot of tools in this area. By the time we have a survivor and a perpetrator, we have failed.
That from Republican Senator Joni Ernst, joined by Democratic Senator Gillibrand on legislation that is bipartisan dealing with sexual assault in the military. Federal agencies are investigating at least two possible incidents here in this country, including one near the White House that took place reportedly last November that appears similar to mysterious, invisible attacks that have led to often debilitating symptoms for dozens of U.S. personnel overseas. CNN broke the initial story, reporting that the Pentagon and other agencies are looking into the matter with no clear conclusions at the moment. It came up during a Senate hearing today with the Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines. She was asked about this. Here is Senator Jeanne Shaheen, a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee.
Director Haines, I would like to begin with you because I'm sure you've seen the report on CNN today that suggests that there were at least two possible incidents on U.S. soil of the directed energy attacks that have created symptoms, sometimes called Havana syndrome, in a number of our personnel. One of the incidents described here happened on the Ellipse in late 2020, and that's very close to the White House. So I'm not going to ask you if that report is correct or not, because I recognize that there has been a real effort to try and keep this information classified. But I do want to ask you about the concern that I have that kind of clamp down on information that's available to Congress, that's available to the public, has led to leaks, and it's not clear whether the information we're getting is correct or incorrect. And so I wonder if you could speak to that and to what more can be done to declassify some of that information, share it with members of Congress in a way that allows us to better respond. After all, we have to fund operations, and there are a lot of personnel. Not a lot. There are personnel who have been harmed who we need to make sure get the care and benefits they need.
Thank you, Senator. And thank you for your
attention on this issue. It's critically important, and it's something that I know General Barrier, I know across the intelligence community, frankly, leaders are focused on this issue. On your particular question with respect to information, I'd be happy to look at this with you, to be honest. I think I completely understand getting the information is critical for you to be able to respond to these issues and ensure that you're able to make good decisions. Maybe we can talk more about this also in closed session on these questions. And I think, our concern obviously with the classification is because we believe that either it's protecting sources and methods and it's critical to our national security, and we'll have to figure that out with you, but you should certainly have access to the classified information, and we should figure out if there's a way to help you address these issues more generally.
Well, again, I would argue that with stories like this, with stories that have appeared over the last 2 years, really, and those people who have been affected, who have gone public, that the horse is out of the barn on this. The information is already out there, and I think it behooves us all to try and make sure that the information that gets out is accurate and that people understand what's happening and that there is an effort to respond to that. So I would urge you to consider that.
That from the Senate Armed Services Committee and Jeanne Shaheen, a Democrat from New Hampshire and the Director of National Intelligence. Some more background, by the way. Those sickened reported similar symptoms to CIA and State Department personnel impacted overseas. Officials quickly began to investigate the incident known as the Havana Syndrome. The name refers to unexplained symptoms that U.S. personnel in Cuba began experiencing back in 2016. Those symptoms include complaints that included ear popping, vertigo, pounding headaches, and nausea, sometimes accompanied by a piercing directional noise. And now to London in a story that is making a lot of headlines across Great Britain. Prime Minister Boris Johnson coming under scrutiny for the redecoration of his official apartment, or as they call it in the UK, a flat. Britain's political spending watchdog announcing an investigation into whether funds used to pay for the refurbishing of 11 Downing Street were properly disclosed. And during question time Wednesday, this exchange between the Prime Minister and the head of the Labour Party.
It's been widely reported that Lord Brownlow, who just happens to have been given a peerage by the Conservative Party, was asked to donate £58,000 to help repay for the cost of this refurbishment. Can the Prime Minister, if he's so keen to answer, confirm, did Lord Brownlow make that payment for that purpose?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I think I've answered this question several times now. And the answer is that I have covered the costs. I have met the requirements that I've been obliged to meet in full. And when it comes to the taxpayer and the costs of Number 10 Downing Street, it was the previous Labour government. I think Tony Blair racked up a bill of £350,000. And I think what the people of this country want to see is minimising taxpayer expense. They want to see a government that's focused on their needs and delivering more homes for the people of this country and cutting council tax, which is what we're doing. And it's on that basis that I think people are going to judge our party on May the 6th.
Keir Starmer.
Answer the question. That's what the public scream at their televisions every PMQs. Answer the question. The Prime Minister hasn't answered the question. He knows he hasn't answered the question. He never answers the question.
And of course, C-SPAN covers Question Time in Great Britain. The London Guardian is reporting the following quote. Prime Minister Johnson is being urged by senior Tories to come clean about the funding of his flat refurbishment as it emerged that a former Labour chancellor refusing to join a trust overseeing Downing Street upkeep out of concerns it could lead to a cash for access scandal. The story is available online at theguardian.com. And on our podcast, The Weekly, an in-depth look at the new census numbers and what they mean for congressional redistricting. It is one of the biggest political battles looming in the states across the country, especially those 13 states either gaining or losing House seats. Reed Epstein has been looking at the numbers and what it means, the New York Times reporter making the following observation.
Well, you know, I was surprised that the numbers didn't meet the projections, frankly. We thought there would be more seats moving from the Northeast and Midwest to the South and West. The projections suggested that Florida would add 2 seats and Texas would add 3 and Arizona would add 1 for a shift of 6 from the Midwest and Northeast to the South and West. And the shift wound up being half of that, 3 seats. And so that is a big difference when it comes to not just congressional representation, but the Electoral College counts over the next 10 years. And frankly, what the amount of resources and political power that those states have in the Congress.
New York Times politics reporter Reed Epstein, among our guests on C-SPAN's The Weekly. The podcast can also be heard every Friday afternoon at 5:30 Eastern Time here on C-SPAN Radio. And this program, Washington Today, it's also available as a podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter at C-SPAN Radio. All of our coverage on the web at cspan.org. For the Thursday edition, I'm Steve Scully, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.